Good afternoon. My apologies for being late. The House Judiciary Committee is in session. In attendance are Representative Coghill, Representative Ramirez, Representative Holmes, Representative Gatto. Representative Grunberg is down the hall and will attend as soon as he's done with some of his affairs, and we expect Representative Dahlstrom and Lynn here shortly. This afternoon, gentlemen, we appreciate your patience very much. We assume that you have less to talk about, because we're all very happy to learn through the newspaper that the population of those incarcerated has actually declined. And I want to applaud all arms of corrections and law enforcement and the court system for what is a positive trend and not an anomaly. With that, if you'll introduce yourself and take us through your presentation. We don't have any sort of a PowerPoint before us. I don't know if you had prepared one, you're welcome, and it's good to see you as friends again. And we have the same members. Representative Dahlstrom is walking into the room, and the new member who has joined us this year is our esteemed colleague, Representative Gatto. With that, if you'll introduce yourself, gentlemen, and if the two of you are going to take turns, just please reintroduce yourself for Susan's benefit, and keep the microphone a little bit closer than where it is at the end of the table. Thank you. The floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and for the opportunity to appear before your committee today. My name is Sam Edwards, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections, Population Management. Deputy Director Brian Brandenburg is with us also today. He can introduce himself. And we also have with us April Wilkerson from the Admin Division here in Juneau, and Richard Schmitz with our Media and Special Projects as well.
Brian Brandenburg, Deputy Director, Division of Institutions.
Welcome, gentlemen.
If I could start then, with just a beginning, we were going to present a department overview, and what we brought was one that the commissioner had done previously. And what we wanted to do with that is just compare where we were before with where we are today. One of the first things that we did was look at the mission statement when we came into administration in January of 2007. The mission statement for the department at that point was to protect the public by incarcerating and supervising prisoners. It covers a lot of what the department does. We wanted a little more meat to that, and what we settled on was the Alaska Department of Corrections enhances the safety of our communities. We provide secure confinement, reformative programs, and a process of supervised community reintegration. That's what we started with when we came on as what we needed to do in order to address what we considered to be the department's biggest problem, and that was recidivism. When we came on, this administration has been relatively stable. When we came on, Commissioner Schmidt, Deputy Commissioners Dwayne Peoples, myself, and our directors of institutions, Garland Armstrong, Probation and Parole, Donna White, and the one change in our executive group has been the Director of Admin Services. Char Griffin retired, and we brought on Leslie Houston. So a relatively very stable department for the first 2 years, which we've appreciated. We started with acknowledging that we are one of six states that are unified, which basically means that we operate the jails and the prisons. Most departments of corrections nationwide deal strictly with sentenced felons in the prison environment. We have in-state 12 correctional institutions with a total population capacity of 3,604 general beds, 3,715 maximum capacity beds. This is different from when we came on. We came on, we evaluated all the institutions. We looked at the capacities that we were using at that time and went in and counted actual physical beds that were in each of these facilities, and that's the number that I just gave you. When we came on, that number was approximately 500 less. So those beds we have added to the capacities of the 12 institutions. Some of that population, approximately 130 beds of that population, were in the gymnasium in Fairbanks, 90 beds there, and 40 beds in the gymnasium in what used to be the Cook Inlet pretrial facility in Anchorage. Now it's Anchorage Complex West. I'll brag just a little bit. When we came on, the population in the institutions was at 108% of capacity, and it went up as high as 117% at one point. If we use, and that was using the old numbers, if we use those same old numbers today, we would be at 102%. Under the new numbers, where we counted all the physical beds that are actually there, we're at 93% capacity today. It sounds like we... Yes, sir.
Go ahead. I'll just finish your thought, and I have a question, please.
It sounds like that we have considerable extra beds in the institutions. We do not. Again, like I said, 90 of those beds are in the gymnasium in Fairbanks, and we've had that closed for approximately a month now. And when you spread the rest of those beds around the state, there are a few beds available in all the facilities, but not. It sounds like we have 7% empty beds. We do, but it's not as simple as that.
Thank you. And just so I get a sense around the table, first, our colleague, Representative Lynn, has joined us. Secondly, just here at the table, I've had the benefit of seeing both the facilities, the Anchorage facility and the Fairbanks facility. Have the members here seen either or both of the facilities that Sam is referring to?
I've seen
both?
Anchorage and then Highland Mountain.
Oh. Yeah, I've seen Lemon Creek, and I've seen the detention facility in Anchorage.
Okay.
I have been as a guest in every facility except for Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
some have non-paying guests.
And some have visited the facilities in Oregon.
Yes. Ouch. Would you go over just on that point so that it's clear to all the members? Every department does, every across the state has interesting accounting mathematics for how we count things. Every department has innovated different counting methodologies. Would you share with us, please, like the Fairbanks facility? My understanding is that when you added beds in the gymnasium and you added volume to the facility, as soon as there was a new bed, then it was counted as another bed. And so when you take away those 90, those little ski things, the boats, right? Thank you for the terminology. When you take the boats away, but how many beds were there when you had, when you say 108%, was that the 200 beds plus the 90 boats in Fairbanks, and then you were at 108%, and now you're at 93% of the 200 since the 90 the 90 boats have been taken away? Well, it's really an important point about capacity and volume. Can you give us your methodology? And every department does this, so we just want to understand how you count beds and heads in a typical correction facility, say like the Fairbanks one, where there were 90 of these boats in the gymnasium, and now the boats are gone.
Certainly. Brian can certainly give you more detail. I can give you an overview of what that is.
Okay.
When we came in January of 07, the Fairbanks facility being a specific example, they counted the design capacity beds that were in the institution without counting the beds in the gymnasium,
which is about 200. Is that correct, Sam?
226.
Okay.
226, and then we added a capacity of 90 in the gymnasium. Actually, we didn't add them. They were there when we came in. they were counted as being over the operational capacity of the institution. When we came in and said, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to count every real bed that's there, not the plastic boats that you had mentioned. We're going to count real beds. And that included two gymnasiums in specific, one being Fairbanks, which was 90 beds. Those we added to this capacity. So when we take those off, and it is our intent to remove those from the count within the next month and a half or 2 months, our capacity at Fairbanks will be reduced by 90. So we added every real bed that was in any of the 12 facilities. They are part of the capacity of the institution now. When we say that we're at 100% departmentally, that means that there is a real bed for every person that we have in any of those institutions without them having to be on a boat as overflow.
So that we just understand the volume and capacity, because it's so critical to correction facilities. There were 226, and you were at 108%. So is that 108% of 226? Or 226?
The 108% was department-wide.
Oh, okay. I understand.
And then we would have to look at Fairbanks and see what they were individually as far as excess of their capacity.
So when you're then to stay aligned with your methodology, so now when you're at 93%, you're at 93%, but none of the temporary bed facilities, none of the boats counted towards your count. So we have seen a significant real reduction.
Yes, sir. From our highest point, we're down
226
from what we were before.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you. We talk about space, and we use the word beds, but there's also medical facilities, food facilities. There's another one I had in mind. Oh, laundry facilities. Can you cap out on your space because you don't have enough kitchen space, and say that capacity is now, or is the capacity always defined by where you can put a bed?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, that's an excellent question, and we most certainly can cap out, not because we run out of space to put more beds, but because the kitchen facility isn't able to support more people, or the medical facility is not able to support our laundry, our maintenance. Any of that could limit how many we could put in a facility.
And I was going to say even fire exits, capacity of fire exits. There has to be more things that limit you than just, can I stick a bed in here, or we would just keep putting beds in until all the heads touched each other and all the feet touched each other and got to get out in groups.
That's exactly right. We would not choose to do that even if there was not a limit, because there are limits beyond which it's whether it's personal space or just ratios. That it's not efficient to operate it, or is safe to operate it.
And I'm going to follow up because I'm curious: is a bed defined as so many square meters?
The bed is not defined as so many square meters.
The space where the bed is allowed.
Where we get into that specifically is when we're looking at American Correctional Association accreditation process. It will tell you how many square feet you need per prisoner, how many beds could be in a specific space, how many plumbing fixtures, how much day room space, all that. It would tell you how much you need in order to be accredited.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sam. Please continue.
That gets us into the 12 institutions. I'll point out one other institution, and we've already mentioned that one. That's the Anchorage Complex. Almost since it opened, that facility, it's the pretrial facility for the Anchorage area. It has a capacity from design capacity of 852, and it was more consistently up toward 1,000 than it was its capacity of 852. That facility on today's count is 15 beds under its capacity, so it is 837.
What was the number you said prior to that?
The design capacity was 852, and we were frequently close to 1,000, and have even exceeded 1,000 on occasion there. So that was pretty major accomplishment to evaluate that population, and what we've end up doing is evaluating them and moving people and balancing institutions so that we did not have just that one far over capacity and another that had available beds.
Can you offer me a little editorializing away from the numbers for a moment? And we had a hearing, I think, 6 or 8 months ago with the correction officers, and there was really such an acute morale breakdown. Would you talk to the committee a little bit about what happens to the those that are incarcerated and to the correction officers when we're better able to manage the facility numbers-wise, because the facilities are so crowded. I mean, you can feel...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
And I would like to hear that, too. One of the things that he might help describe in that is what he began to talk about was the movement of people, because in a pretrial facility has a very different movement thing, and because of that, the morale issue might be tied to that, in that they have to move people in and out of facilities that aren't pretrial because of that. And so maybe you could help us over the context of that, because I think that has a significant
Absolutely.
Part of it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that clarification. And to the chair, what I think you would see in any correctional facility, whether it was a pretrial facility or a sentence facility, is that as long as there is space for the individuals to have somewhere that they can kind of get away a little bit, they're not more in a room than what it was designed for, there's sufficient areas for them to go to, whether it's program space or recreation space, whatever, you're going to find a more relaxed population there. Certainly the staff and how it impacts morale with them, the more crowded it is, the more tense it is, and I think that applies to anything, whether it's a jail or a school or a committee hearing for that matter. But
if you wanted to pause there, we'd all like to just suggest that for a moment.
But you know, those things you see, what we've done to try and give them more space and to balance the populations around is we did exactly what Representative Coghill mentioned. We took some of the people from the Anchorage complex who are pretrial. They've not been convicted. They belong in an intake facility. That's where they would stay if there was space for them. When we exceed capacity there, we identify the ones who are of less risk or who have court dates that are off in the future, and those individuals we would move to another facility such as Palmer Correctional Center in the Anchorage area. And that allows them the space at the complex so that they're not so overcrowded that people are tense. And I think the numbers and the space has more to do with it than almost anything else. The staffing piece, I'll talk about that a little bit later on or at any point, but I will mention that we had, I think when we came before the committee last, we were at like 737 correctional officers that we had hired at that point. We were, for the last week or so, we've been at 769. And it's actually better than that. We had 11 staff with start dates in either by February or within the first part of February that would put us up to 780.
Go ahead.
Question for me first. We've been joined by our colleague, Representative Grunberg. We're happy to see you. And then the hiring freeze that was announced by the governor, excluded public safety. Does that include or exclude corrections? How do we count corrections people?
The correctional officer and the probation officer are not included in the freeze.
Meaning that if they're if we lose folks, we're able to recruit replacement
Correct.
People. So the safety for those correction officers is always we're always mindful of that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, kind of keeping on the movement and morale issue, one of the things that we have struggled with down through years is how to allow the prisons that don't have pretrial to continue a contiguous program of recovery, whatever that program may be. And so I think when we get to capacity and you move pretrial people in, then we're making another morale issue both in the population and in the officers' ranks. So help me, am I assuming that correctly? And secondly, is there some way that you've been able to help with that or work with that?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, that is correct. When you move a short-term person into a longer-term sentence facility, the pretrial person is not settled. They, number one, they don't know if they're even going to be convicted. They don't know if they're going to be able to bail out. They don't know when they will be getting out. So one thing that happens with them is they're not able to get involved in any long-term program that we might have going there. And that's just for them. For the longer-term prisoner who's in that facility, they now have to deal with people that are coming and going, and that's while we've adjusted to it, you know, certainly that's disruptive to a point.
And I may have misunderstood, but it seemed to me like you had longer-term prisoners also that would bump around the state because of pretrial crowd. And that's been a complaint that I've heard coming to my office from time to time is that they were not able to complete things that would have given them a ability to get credit on their sentence for good time based on that program, and then get bumped from one part of the state to the other, and then they have to start all over again. And I think that is at least one complaint I've heard several times since I've been in the legislature.
Do you want to take that, Brian?
Brian Brandenburg, Deputy Director, through the chair to Representative Coghill. That's certainly what you said, certainly has been true in the past. One of the things that this administration has done, thanks in part to the legislature, who gave us some funding to actually put back in place some programming that we didn't necessarily have available to us before, is that we are, by the end of February, we'll have in place five different short-term, three-month-long intensive outpatient substance abuse programs in four different facilities and one in the Anchorage area in the halfway houses, which will allow for an opportunity for folks to participate in those programs. We still have the two long-term RSAT programs at Highland Mountain for the women and in Wildwood for the men, and then, of course, in Arizona we have a program down there also. And those are level three programs, which are a little longer term. They meet court requirements. The 3 to 4 month programs that we're just putting into place are level two programs, which also meet court requirements. Within that, we have an anger management program that is court approved. So I think we're going in the direction where we can start to allow the opportunity for more of our inmates to complete and get credit for some of the things that you obviously have had complaints about in the past.
And Mr. Chairman, that does affect morale of the officers because they have huge pushback when they're in discontent that just makes life miserable.
And then I'd like to, on Representative Coghill's point, and wherever it's appropriate in your presentation, if you could address two issues for me. One was unique to Fairbanks, and one I heard about from a gathering of Native Alaskans in the Fairbanks area. It was in our newspaper some time ago that the because of the overcrowding, the chapel had been moved, shrunk, that sort of thing. Would you, not specific to the Fairbanks facility, but at the appropriate time, it's important to a number of us here at this table the opportunity for the expression of, you know, a faith-based program, because so many of us draw our strength from the Lord, or however we pray or worship. Secondly, I was at a gathering a year ago in Fairbanks, I think, with a roundtable of Alaska Natives who were very concerned about cultural events, potlatches, and the ability of certain food boxes and unique cultural foods to be able to make it into, I think, particularly the Arizona prison, where it was so helpful for the morale of Alaskans that were separated from their families and their culture. And at the appropriate time, if you can address both of those issues, the opportunity to have a safe space in a chapel, and then how you're handling the cultural things for the that subset of our incarcerated population, please. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going returning to the overcrowding issue, I was wondering, we had a lot of discussion in this committee over the last couple of years about the issue of ankle monitoring. And I was wondering if at some point, either now or later in the presentation, you could update us a little bit on if there's been an increase in the use of ankle monitoring, and whether that may be in any way helping the overcrowding issue.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Holmes, that one is coming up shortly. I'll go ahead and address that one now. However, when we came on again in January of 07, the electronic monitoring numbers statewide were, I believe, at 194 or 196, one or the other. We experienced two things within the first year, and one of those was we evaluated the staff that were involved in that program, specifically in the Anchorage area. We had, I believe it was five correctional officers in addition to the complement of probation officers who were staffing that unit. The correctional officers were there kind of on loan from the correctional complex. The correctional complex was understaffed at the time and using a tremendous amount of overtime. We looked at that and said, you know, these PCMs belong to the complex. We're going to remove them from electronic monitoring and put them back in the institution. We did that. We saw an immediate drop in the numbers in Anchorage on electronic monitoring. In fact, we dropped down from a high of 196 down into the low 100s for months that we were there. We devoted attention to the program, not by giving it more staff, but by looking at the staff and asking them, you know, why the drop? How do we get the applications to you? How do we get more people on there? So we looked at that, and then we also had HV90 that came along. It had an impact on some people who would have volunteered to go on that program because the essence as far as electronic monitoring was, if you were serving time in a halfway house or some other 24-hour facility, you would get good time for the time that you were serving. If you went on electronic monitoring, you would not. So in effect, if you were sentenced to 3 months and you did your time in a halfway house, you would only have to do 2 months. You would get 1 month good time. If you went on electronic monitoring, you would have to do 3 months. Some people were willing to go on electronic monitoring because it meant I get to live at home and hopefully my work life is and family life are not disrupted. Probably anyone in this room would have said, yes, I will go on electronic monitoring even if I have to do more time without credit for good time. Not everyone that we get in fits that category. So we did have some people who said, I don't want to go on there solely because of that. What I can tell you is that today we was our number today?
184.
Our number on electronic monitoring today is 184, which is very close to the numbers that we had before either of these events happened. And actually it's probably closer to 200 because numbers that are on electronic monitoring that don't reflect because they're not in the department's custody are the people that are in the specialty courts, whether it's DWI or drug court, that they refer to that as a condition of that program. So on any given day, we have anywhere from 2 to 5 in Fairbanks that are on that, and anywhere from 10 to 15 in Anchorage that are on that program.
Gentlemen, 4 more areas that I'm interested in. I'm finding that without the benefit of a PowerPoint where I can't kind of flip ahead to see if something's covered, I'm kind of going through it as we're all mindful of gang activity on the streets. I'm going to be interested if we're seeing any signs of gang activity inside of a facility. Second, I hope that you'll touch on drugs and contraband inside the facility. Third, because of Speaker Chenault's and my shared interest in the Hang'em High ideology, I am interested in what it would mean structurally to have to offer death row accommodations. And fourth, I met with some members, with John Sear and some of the members of that facility, and we are very likely going to offer as a judiciary bill shortly. They did a recent meth bust, and in the house they found the names and addresses of many police officers and undercover police officers who have since, you know, they fear for their families. And so I wanted to find out from you whether that would at all be a shared concern of correction officers and management of those 800 people, the ability to at the time that they're employed to automatically have their personal information, their home address shaded off of the property rolls, and whether that's something that we, when we contemplate that for law enforcement, whether we should also contemplate that for correction officers as a matter of an additional layer of safety for your workforce. So as you get to those things in your presentation, thank you. And Representative Ralston.
And Mr. Chair, if I may add one more thing, and you can fit it in wherever is most convenient. I'm curious to know about the accreditation standards and if they are different for a lifetime customer of yours rather than somebody who's going to be there 3 to 5 years, 8 years, we know is going to be back out in society. You know, everything from do they have the same amount of space, are we required to offer activities. I just think there's a real fine line of compassion and treating people humanly, and yet I really don't have any tolerance for the crimes that get them in there for life. So I'm interested to know about that.
What's going on?
Where are you going to start?
Well, they can be short answers.
Yeah, thank you. I think we can get to all those. Some of them wouldn't show up just in the normal presentation, and I think maybe I'll speed up a little bit in the normal presentation where we can come back to those.
And to that end, because we've had you before the committee before, and we saw this when we did the when we had our meet and greet with the commissioner designee, we're much more interested, I think, in policy, where how the corrections is evolving policy-wise, necessarily more so than an inventory of what you have. That is, of the statistics are of interest to the committee, but we like to know, I believe, where you are policy-wise and what this committee can do to help you enhance some of the policy initiatives to better underline the things that are working and to eliminate some of the dead weight that is not necessarily helping. So we're far more interested. So if you want to speed up through some of the inventory and get to the policy, I think speaking for the committee, we're more interested in that.
And I would also add, if I may, Mr. Chairman, the problems above the ordinary that you suffer in trying to do your job there, and how the policy might a change in policy might help you deal with those problems.
Thank you. Representative Gatto.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Does Arizona prison population figure into any of your statistics, or is that almost like a different department?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, they figure into any statistics that we have that would be overall count, you know, furlough, halfway house participation, certainly recidivism. What they would not figure into is you wouldn't see that we were at a you know, 105% because of how many we had in Arizona. It has no impact on that. Other than that, any statistics regarding programming or supervision once they're released, all that is the same for the Arizona population as it would be the population here in Alaska.
Thank you.
We have a couple of things that I think the committee is probably already aware of as far as expansion in the institutions in the state. One of them being we had received authority in funding for three temporary houses at Palmer Correctional Center. Those were 19 beds each is what we did. All of those are completed, and the third one will come on online February 1st. So that gives us an additional 57 there. In Fairbanks, we went through and revisited space inside the existing facility again, and we reclaimed some space that had been given up for program and office, and turned that back into housing, moved the medical around, and then put program space upstairs in what was the dining area, which we no longer do central dining, so we had a little extra space. That'll give us 38 beds. Those are not online now, but they should be online within the next 2 months, I'm thinking is when they're scheduled to come online. Those would be permanent beds that we would not be looking to remove at a later date. We've talked about the institutions, and that gets the most of the attention generally when we come forward, because those are the 24-hour facilities, and the majority of the budget is directed to that. There's been significant interest in the probation parole division. We have historically had trouble filling all our probation officer positions. We are currently, at this time, we've filled every probation officer position we have in the division within our funding vacancy and turnover rate. I think we may have exceeded that by one or two. We'll have to adjust out. It is just so great to be able to fill the positions that we hated to stop. What we have experienced over the last year that I think is due in part to the increased numbers of probation officers that we have on the streets is we had 240 fewer revocations in 2008 than we had in 2007. I think part of that you would have to put on the officer has more time to deal with their caseloads than they do when they have the vacant positions in their offices. And the other thing there is just a reemphasis when we're talking with the staff about, you know, what the job is. Certainly public protection, but remembering that one way that you protect the public is to work these people through so that you don't have to violate them and put them back in prison. So those things, we're really really pleased with the results in the community on that. The other thing, and this gets into philosophy of the department, certainly how the probation and parole officers are dealing with the people on the street is part of our philosophy. Another one that's coming up next is the benefit of transitioning a person from a prison or jail setting through a community residential center prior to their release. When we came on again, we had 614 community residential center beds, halfway house beds throughout the state. What we have today are 753 beds. We were able to resecure some that had been given up previously, and then we got an opportunity to bring on an additional 43 this past year. And the more exciting thing about that is that we are able to fill those beds on any given day. And when we came on, we had empty beds in the halfway houses, even at the reduced numbers. We were able to get more beds and fill all those slots on any given day. With a very limited exception, those beds are filled. The facility in Arizona was mentioned when we started. We had 1,060 people in the Red Rock facility in Arizona. Today we are running at 880-ish we have funding for 900 out there. And at the time that we came on, the plan was that we would...
Just a Red Rock question. Is Arizona receptive to receiving our prisoners, or are we starting to build some sort of resistance? Is there Arizona law being passed that prevents it? In other words, the future of being able to continue at Red Rock is in jeopardy or just normal?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, there is certainly discussion from the Arizona Department of Corrections and the current governor in Arizona as to what prisoners the state should be willing to accept down there, whether they would want to allow other states to send in people who were doing serious crimes of violence, sex offenders, that sort of thing, coming into the state. Today, that still is not a limitation on us. Nothing to say that next year, or tomorrow, or the year after, that they couldn't say, here are more strict limits on who you can send down, and that would absolutely impact what we were doing as far as using that as a way to manage our population.
Just a follow up. So I take it we have not heard from the Arizona legislature on setting policy, but only from the Department of Corrections in Arizona, maybe on setting policy. I'm just curious to know how far we need to go to find out if it's at risk.
We have, the commissioner may have more detailed information than I do, but the information that we get consistently is from the company that we lease beds from in Arizona, Corrections Corporation of America. They obviously have a large stake in what type of prisoner they're able to take in the state of Arizona. And when we hear generally through the news media, more so than from Department of Corrections or from the legislature in Arizona, then that's who we go and ask, hey, this is how you're making your living. Are we at risk of not being able to send this type of prisoner to Arizona?
Thank you.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The chairman mentioned earlier that there are some issues with having the prisoners far away, some issues maybe with the cultural exchanges and also being far away from family. It's obviously not ideal. But I know there are also economics involved in this, and I was just wondering, does the department have a position on whether they would ideally like to have enough beds in the state that we could bring all the prisoners home, or does that seem to be uneconomical? Where, if anywhere, is there any sort of policy of the department at this point?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, when we came in, there already was plan in progress to build a large institution in the state, the purpose of which would be to bring back all the prisoners that we were housing out of state. Even though the current plan is reduced in scope, that is still the plan, is to bring back all our prisoners when the new facility opens.
Thank you.
Please continue. Thanks, Sam.
We have, one more thing, and this will play to the department's philosophy again. A little bit. Beds that we hope to bring online hopefully by the end of this fiscal year, and these are in at the Wildwood Correctional Center in Kenai. These are refurbishing existing buildings down there. Anyone who's familiar with it, it's an old military base, and we're refurbishing a couple buildings outside the fence that had not been used in the past. What these would be, and it looks like 68 beds is what we'll be able to get out of that, is we are designing a minimum work release facility, which would allow us to house lower risk people there, minimum custody people obviously, and also to perform what would be a furlough function here in Anchorage. We don't have that ability to furlough a person in the Kenai area. So what happens there if they have a person who is eligible to leave the facility and furlough, we end up sending them to Anchorage, and they may do quite well, but if they're planning on on upon release going back to Kenai, it really does not do much for them as far as allowing them to look for housing or a job in the community that they're going to be living in. What we're talking about bringing online, the minimum work release facility in Kenai would allow us to do that very thing.
If I may take a moment to interrupt you and compliment you, it sounds like you're really quite successful at tweaking your system around these 12 facilities to make it easier to that you have found some relief. You know, as we pause to talk policy for a moment, it sounds like you're trying to keep people in Kenai so they can find their way back to work, that we're using the ankle monitors in a very successful fashion and giving the population an opportunity cost, which is 100% on ankle release or two-thirds on actual good time and then good time served, and opening up economics, you know how there's the bell curve, and it sounds like whereas it used to be a steeper curve, that you're really doing an excellent job in creating some shoulders to the correctional facilities is how it sounds to me. And it sounds like it's good for the population, it's good for the correction officers, and obviously it's good for the public good and public safety. So I just wanted to pause to tell you that I'm just impressed with what I'm hearing. Is that what other members are hearing also? And so kudos.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you. We appreciate that. We do have an experienced executive team that we brought on. Between Brian and myself, we probably have 50 years sitting here. Only five with Brian. Actually, we've been very fortunate that way, and all our staff. Basically grew up in this Department of Corrections, so we certainly do know the facilities and what the issues are, and that has allowed us to go in and tweak and see what we could see what we could do in every facility.
And then just to recap, because Representative Coghill has such an acute interest in this subject.
And I apologize. There's a phone call I just had to take, so I'm sorry.
Representative Coghill, what we were just admiring is this approach that Corrections has taken. They've added homes in the Palmer area, 68 more beds that are the equivalent of minimum security to allow furloughed workers and work release. Kenai did not have a furlough facility, so that population was going to Anchorage, and then were displaced in Anchorage, and then to a certain degree when they returned home to Kenai, then they were displaced in Kenai, which was affecting recidivism rates without question. You can just hear it, so the committee was really complimenting the corrections department on their ability to kind of feather out the shoulders and take pressure off the system, and to probably, I would assume, that accounts for some of the lowering of the recidivism rate and the morale issue with the population as well as the correction officers and the public good. And so it bears repeating.
It's, thank you very much.
Impressive.
Thank you, Chairman.
When we were, the commissioner gave this introductory piece before he head down works in progress staffing review to ensure all the staff were working where they were budgeted for. We mentioned that partly with the electronic monitoring piece, finding that we had five staff that were on loan there that belonged to the complex. We moved them back where they belong. And to look at every position throughout the department to make sure that it was where it needed to be and that it was doing what it needed to do. We've completed the first phase of that, which basically is just looking at initial numbers and where a post should be. That part we are pretty much done with. The second phase of that, which is where we actually look at the function that's going on there and the type person that's being supervised by who and where, that we're still doing, and we're expecting that will have a continued positive impact on safety and reentry and eventually recidivism. That's, again, putting the person where they belong, where they can take advantage of the opportunities that we do have for them to prepare themselves while they're incarcerated, moving them into CRCs, halfway houses, before their release date, in every case where we're allowed to do that, and then the method of supervision once they're in the community under probation, parole, supervision. One thing that I heard one of our probation officers mention in a leadership management program that we offered or had offered through National Institute of Corrections, he was talking about supervision in the field, and nationally, pretty much, you're looking at 66% recidivism rate. And he was saying in this case that basically you could divide that population into thirds. A third of the population were going to succeed almost if in spite of what we did. They were prone to succeed. There was a third on the other end who very likely were not going to succeed in spite of what we did. And it was that third in the middle that we should be devoting the majority of our resource to, and that's where we can impact that 66% recidivism rate. Certainly that's part of the evaluation on each position and how they're functioning, because we want to devote that limited resource where it's going to do the most good for us.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That I echo the chairman's comments about really appreciating all that you're doing. Sorry. In particular, this makes a lot of sense that you're going to have, it's going to be like students in school, I would think. There are some who are going to succeed regardless of what you do. There are some who aren't going to regardless of what you do, and you got to find out those people in the middle. How hard is it to identify which third an individual person falls into?
That, Mr. Brandenburg, is right up his line.
I'd love to answer through the chair to Representative Holmes. We are in the process of reviewing our classification system. It's about 20 years old and has what we found through a couple different consultants is that it tends to overclassify our population, tends to be on the high end. And so what we're looking at is a way to review that classification system that allows us to identify the folks that are a higher risk, but yet also identify the folks with a lower risk so that we can focus our resources appropriately to deal with those. Research kind of tells us that the lower third that Mr. Edwards was talking about, only about 11% of them will recidivate, which is a pretty low figure when you look at the trends that we have. And so really doing anything with them isn't, if you just leave them alone, they're going to do just fine. The middle percent, the middle third, you get between 15% and 35%, 45% of them recidivate. And so those are the ones that you tend to want to put most of your resources into, because those are the ones where you're going to see the majority of the change take place. The upper end, those are folks that are some of the longer-term inmates that you were asking about earlier, mm-hmm. Vice Chair. And those are folks that you don't want to spend a lot of resources on, because research says that if you do, you're going to tend to make them better criminals. And so we don't want to do that. We want to focus on the folks that we can give an opportunity to make some changes in their lives so that they don't come back. A tool that we're looking at using LSIR, which is a level of service inventory. And that gives us a risk assessment of each individual as well as a need assessment. And so if it works, we're doing some pilot studies with it right now, looking at the possibility of utilizing it as our sentence classification tool, which will then also, it'll give us the custody level, but also give us an idea of what sort of programs this person needs to be involved in. To answer the Vice Chair's question, 80% of our population is going to be released from prison. There are only 20% that are going to stick around, and the longer-term inmates are housed basically at Red Rock and at Spring Creek. The housing situation for those folks really isn't any different than any of our other inmates. We tend to treat them all the same, other than the fact that they have a little longer time to do. What our focus has been on is, because so many of our inmates are getting out, is that we really, as a department, have begun to develop some reentry programs, both within the halfway house and also within our facilities, to help enhance the opportunity for these people when they leave the department to not come back. We're focusing on job skills, we're focusing on education, we're focusing on treatment, housing, sober support groups, and reunification with families. And we found, and what we've learned, is that if we can do that and provide those opportunities for those folks when they get out, they're not going to come back. And all of that is in its infancy. I mean, it's in development, and we just recently started a pilot project at Spring Creek Reentry and Transition Unit. Mr. Edwards was talking about earlier, we have a unit with 6 months to get out and a unit with 18 months to get out. And so we're putting programs emphasizing reentry within both of those to help those folks take advantage of that. So some real exciting things are starting to happen for us.
Maybe just follow up and just comment. I think that's wonderful, and I've been impressed, I have to say, from the beginning of my term 2 years ago, talking with you and with the commissioner, that you put such an emphasis on reentry and reducing recidivism. I think that's wonderful.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you. Seems like I like double-blind studies, and by having Red Rock, we have a double-blind study with this regard. I hear many, many times that we need to bring the prisoners home because if you take them away from family and their social contacts and whatnot, that means they'll stay bad forever. But if you bring them home, they'll immediately do well. I'm exaggerating, but that's the message. Has there been a study that tells me whether or not sending a prisoner to Red Rock is less efficient because recidivism is higher, or sending them there is better because recidivism is lower?
Through the chair to Representative Gatto, we haven't done any studies specifically to differentiate between Red Rock and our population up here. I can tell you that there are a couple studies out there that talk about visitation and the impact that does have on recidivism. And that if inmates have contact with their families, it tends to lower recidivism. That's a study that actually just recently came out. I can make a copy of that available to you so you could look at that. But it would be interesting to see what the difference is between the two, Arizona and Alaska.
If we could tag on that just a little bit, though. Alaska is so large that frequently, you know, if a person is from Barrow or somewhere and comes into the system and ends up at Spring Creek and Seward, they probably aren't very much more likely to get visitation in Seward than they would be if they were in Arizona. So there is that piece. However, that one is important for a couple reasons, and the courts are looking at the visitation issue as to whether as a strong consideration for whether we can send a person out to Arizona, which it might sound like we have, you know, if we've got 5,000 prisoners, it shouldn't be hard to find 1,000 to go to Arizona. It's not that easy. So if we get boxed in with having to consider, you know, if a person has a possibility of a visit that we wouldn't be able to send them, you know, that could certainly have an impact, not just on rehabilitation, but on our ability to manage the population.
Is there not a certain amount of visitation from the community, such as from clergy, Salvation Army, volunteerism, university students, etc., and does that count as connection with the world and therefore is no different than Uncle Charlie just happened to be in town, hey, I'll just stop by and have a smoke with you?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I think that all that is very important as far as helping a person to adjust. In the particular cases, and there's been about three so far that I was mentioning just now, where the court was looking at it, it was specifically dealing with family visitation.
All right, let's proceed from there. Good questions.
We had a project going when we were before the committee last, and that had to do with with OSHA requirements regarding self-contained breathing apparatus in the institutions, and the process to do the fit testing and pass muster as far as being able to have them in the facilities. The department made the decision that we would keep them in there, that it was a valuable tool, an extra tool, not that we were asking our staff to become firefighters without having been trained as firefighters, or that we were asking them to return to units and perform rescue with this apparatus. But we did want it available during the process of evacuating the facilities. We went through the process on that, and we did receive at least what I think is final decision here recently, and that was that we could proceed with those and with the fit testing process. The equipment to perform the fit testing should be here, you know, by the end of this month or early February, and we should begin fit testing in the institutions in February as well.
Representative Calico.
I'm glad to hear that, and there's probably a variety of other areas where that's going to work, so I'll just ask it in a general term. A lot of the discussion down here these days is about workforce development, and there's a lot of things that we require the officers to do, and certainly that goes to the professional staff plus morale. Can you give us a broad definition of not only what you're requiring them to do, but what kind of investments you're making in getting them there?
Or
is that too broad a question?
Representative Coghill. No, I think that's an excellent question. The investment to get us to that point, what OSHA requires is that we go out annually and perform fit testing. In order for us to do that as a minimum, we have to purchase the actual testing machine.
Madam Chair, he might have missed my point. It wasn't on that specific issue. I just wanted to broaden the discussion out on other areas of certification, qualification, leadership, career ladder movement, things like that, that we as a state are helping invest in that workforce.
Oh, certainly. And that is one of the that's down like next on
okay.
Part of that. What we did when we first started, and it took us a full year to start the first program, is we went to the National Institute of Corrections in Colorado and said that we want to identify leadership training programs that we could get our staff involved in, and mid-level training, and then senior level training, and then also executive level training. We completed the first mid-level training, and I think when we graduate 23 individuals out of that program. It was a year-long in duration, and a benefit of that, aside from giving us a more valuable employee in the department and better preparing them to at least look at advancing up through the department if they wanted. What we did is there had to be an assignment that each individual did during this program. We do not have enough staff at the executive level to research every project that we want to do. So what we did is identify things that we wanted to do, and we assigned it to this group. They worked on that for a year. Things that they worked on were health and diet for the institutions. They worked on the information technology program as far as electronic record keeping and retrieving that the department needs to be able to bring you better data when you have us come forward. They looked at the classification process that Mr. Brandenburg mentioned. We had 7 specific projects that they worked on, including expansion for the facilities. So we did that. And while these people were doing that, and they're from around the state and from every part of the department, they were getting to know one another and forming networks that should last through their careers and make people more aware not just of the instant facility that they might be working in or the area that they're in, but what the department is doing and what their role in that is. And when we leave, you know, whenever that is, that there would be people who are ready to step in and take our take our positions. So that's what we're doing with that. We have for the first time in many years our own correctional academy. And I think that's been a tremendous boon to us, just that we weren't sharing it in the facilities that we have, even though they're slated for renovation. They're ours, the people know where they're going, and our people are the ones who are in charge of that. We've ran more correctional and probation officer academies than we had historically because we're bringing on more staff. That piece has not changed too much other than looking for efficiencies there also as far as the qualifications. And then we're looking to that to increase dramatically over the next few years as we get closer to bringing on the prison in Point McKenzie. And I think that's probably the main thing we're doing as far as extra training and credentials for our staff and opportunities to prepare them to advance.
Mr. Chairman, the question I'd asked about investment back into the workforce for career and professional opportunities, and one of the things that we hear from time to time is, even during the time when they were before us in the committee having the discussion about how to keep disease contained and to keep the officers safe, it became a question in my mind as to the investment back into them, and I don't know that I've totally understand it, but I know that this isn't the only place we have to have that discussion. The other thing is, I know that the population that moves in has a significant portion dealing with mental health issues, and so then as far as the workforce is, do they have good counsel for the staff who are not trained for mental health? Do we have staff that helps navigate those coming into the population that need to be at least properly handled? So just a question.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, every inmate that comes into the system it receives a screening within the first 24 hours of their admission and prior to being placed out into open population. And part of that screening is a mental health assessment. I believe nine of our facilities, we have mental health clinicians who are on staff who are there during the week that then receive those referrals and do assessments of those folks. And then if indicated, we have telecommunication processes in place so that they can do telemed with the psychiatrist that we have at central office. Of course, then we have the acute psychiatric unit at Cook Inlet, which is basically an inpatient hospital for the more severe cases. And within that, we also have our mental health staff, our mental health director, and some of the folks that work underneath her provide an ongoing training for correctional officers so that they can recognize and be aware of, signs and symptoms of mental illness and then refer that appropriately so that eliminates some of the risk that is obvious in a situation like that.
That's a high-level discussion. We can drill down later on.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill. Brian didn't mention it, but the first 18 years of his career were as a mental health clinician with the department.
He knows.
Talk to you about that all day long. We are close to being through the primary part of the presentation, and we can get back to the specific issues and any questions. We were talking about challenges, one of them being training and training new correctional officers and probation officers. We did ramp that up with our own correctional academy, which has helped us there. And as far as that training and retention, the management and leadership training that we've partnered with the National Institute of Corrections, I think is going to pay dividends for the department down the road in that area.
Mr. Chairman, I know we're running short on time, but one of the questions, and you don't have to answer it now, and it may be a union administration issue, but one of the things that I have heard and part of my walking in and out of most of these facilities is the debate between 8-hour shifts and 12-hour shifts. And that is a significant morale issue, plus a pay issue, plus a cost issue for you folks. And could you just address it briefly? We don't have to drill down into all the details, but help me understand how to look at that issue.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, that's probably the very last thing that our correctional staff would ever give up before they left the career is that 12-hour shift.
Is that right?
Since it came on in the early 80s, I worked it very briefly. You have a week off. Every other week, you have a week off. People really plan their lives around that. It allows them to do more things. And you'll hear most people say, you know, when we were working 5-8-hour days, it was high pace or stressful or, you know, whatever the issue was or the adjective, it was 2 days were not enough to prepare yourself to come back to work, and the week off is. So any informal poll or study that we've ever done with the staff, there's probably nothing worse than you could do to them than suggest that, hey, the 12-hour shift is going to go away, or do you want to move off that?
Point well taken.
We're going to lose Representative Coghill at 3 o'clock to a meeting with the Senate Rules Chair, but I would invite other members, if we want to go a few minutes over, I would encourage you to bring up any policy initiatives that you would like to see the House Judiciary Committee consider that would help you do your jobs better, manage your population better, lend itself to better public safety, more efficiencies, as well as some of the other bullet point items that were some of the members at the table requested.
Thank you. Certainly on a policy level and a philosophical level, what we said we were going to do when we came in is we wanted protection of the public, and we wanted safe environments in the correctional facility. And one of the primary ways to do that, aside from ensuring that we were able to hire and retain staff to staff the facilities, was to focus on preparing these people in the institution dealing with any treatment issues that they might have, ready to go into the halfway houses, because two of the primary things that you've got to have if you want to be successful upon release is you have to have a place to live and you have to have a way to earn a living. So in any case where we're able, we're going to do that. And then that we supervise people once they're released from custody and under the supervision of probation and parole, we supervise them so that they have the best opportunity to succeed out there. It is relatively easy to catch someone doing something wrong. It's a little more difficult to work with that person and get to know them and work them through those rough places so the public continues to be protected and they're successful out there. And as far as what would benefit us, I don't know that we're prepared today to say any specific type legislation, but certainly an understanding of what we're trying to do, and at least being aware any new legislation that comes out that looks like it would impact that. Not that you shouldn't still do it, obviously, but just an awareness of the impact that it would have down the road as far as the numbers that are in the system and what it would do to recidivism. We would certainly anytime be willing to go and talk to anybody about that. And everything is so interrelated that it's really hard to, whether it's adding another police officer or adding another month to a particular sentence or whatever it is, it's going to have an impact on capacities and dollars, absolutely. There was reference to chapel space as a result, I think, of our crowding. I don't think that we've lost any.
I think it was specifically the revision of the Fairbanks was the chapel, right?
Did we not give them additional
space? I think we downsized the chapel, okay. Is my recollection.
Okay. That might well have happened. To my knowledge, we've not gone in and looked at any space that was devoted to faith-based services and converted that into something where that wouldn't be available to them anymore, nor would that be our intention to do that.
Very good. Thank you.
The native foods and potlatches, we do have those in Arizona, and I know that there always are some number of complaints about the ability to get into the facility when people travel down there, or to get the food items in if they've sent them down there. There always is security to be concerned with going into an institution. And they're always, even if the vast majority of the people coming in are there for, you know, very pure purposes of visiting and continuing culture, there always seems to be one or two people at least who are going to take that opportunity to introduce contraband. So there's always a balance there. How do we continue that service, and how do we maintain security at the same time?
Can the committee get a status report? The chapel question, pretty easy to answer. A sensitivity to cultural connection to home is more significant for me, and because I was struck by the breadth and depth of the sentiment that surrounded the issue when I was in Fairbanks. I can't remember whether you were at that meeting, Sam. It was somebody pretty high up in corrections was there. It was held at the Chena River Convention Center, and it was not this summer, which was an election cycle. I believe it was the summer before. Karen, were you there? Right, and it wasn't a passing point for the folks that were gathered there. I thought it was a significant matter. Were you, Jane? Were you there? And so, if you could get us something written and get us a letter from the Arizona private prison as to their policy position on that. I'm more interested in that than just a glancing remark. I'd like to actually see, a little source data and a letter on that point, please.
Point of clarification, you want specifically from Arizona their policy on cultural activities? Is that
just so that we're clear? Hold on a second. I don't want to go off the record.
Mr. Chair, I was going to say the Alaska Rural Justice System may be able to provide us with a lot of these answers, and I know that the Public Safety Commissioner sits on it. Commissioner Schmidt may sit on it. Quite a few of the rural leaders do, and I think they might already have some of that.
So I thank you very much, Representative Dahlstrom. I think what we might try and do is, Karen, if you and Jane are up to it, we might try and make some contact with that community.
There's been a bunch of follow-up meetings to
yes.
that, too.
And so maybe we can compose a letter, send it to you. It's not meant to be, the tone of that letter is not meant to be confrontational. It's really meant to be informational, but we would like to be able to respond to certain specific points. So I think we'll make that a matter of the Judiciary Committee to send you a letter specifically on that issue, and then see what kind of response we get back from the involved parties. Is that okay with the table? I think that would be a constructive way to handle that. Next item, death row. It's a big deal. You would be surprised at the dialogue and the discussion that stirred up. And while I had you here, I thought, well, not only does it raise a host of other very emotional issues and DNA post-conviction testing, which have also been asked about, but it also would require you, I would assume, to allocate a certain portion of a facility to a death row. Like I'm channeling Mike Chennault.
No.
I'm not going to say Clint Eastwood on the record. I'm not going to do it.
No.
What mechanically would be required if we went down that road? I don't anticipate that happening this year, especially with our colleagues over in the other body. But for the sake of discussion, very briefly, what would be the mechanics that would be required both for a death row as well as for a facility to execute those found guilty of the death penalty.
To the chair, I'd love to give this one to Mr. Brandenburg. He's not. we are looking at exactly what that would entail now. We don't have much detail on whether it's cost or number of staff. I mean, the obvious things are is you would need a center or a house where you actually carried that out, so that we would either take an existing space and convert it to that, and it would, that's all that it would be. That's not really a very multi-use type facility. So we would have that piece. Likely it would involve building a new facility for that. The housing for a person on death row, we certainly have some housing that would be sufficient for that. The volume would be such that we would mix populations there. It would be only the people who were on death row. So at least initially, there would not be very many people in that space. So we'd either have to find a small one and again either build it or just dedicate an existing space that was there. And then the staffing for that, you would want a higher staff prisoner ratio there than probably anywhere else.
Okay.
And you would I believe, and I don't know this personally because I never worked on a unit like that, but certainly the stresses that go along with that job for the staff who work with the prisoner day in, day out is going to be greater than what the average correctional officer would experience. And as the day of an execution comes nearer, I mean, everything that you see and read on those is that the tension level goes up, not just on that unit and for the people who work there, but throughout the department. So we would have to adjust to that. Putting a dollar on it, you know, certainly we're not ready for that.
Okay.
Or even everything that we would need to think of to bring in, but we are starting to look at that because we know we'll be asked that.
Okay, and more germane to this committee, I think, is gang activity. We're sensitive to the fact that it's prominent in various parts of Anchorage. It's seeping into the Fairbanks community. Can you touch on to what extent it has seeped into the correctional facilities themselves? Because we're aware of, you know, locked up raw and, you know, MSNBC and so to what extent are we seeing that in your facilities?
To the chair, we still fortunately are relatively small numbers in our facilities. It certainly does appear on the street and in the news that there are more. And certainly, you know, they're doing more outrageous type crimes with seemingly less regard for consequences. We've not noticed, and Brian, you're welcome to jump in, that type activity is in our institutions right now, where you have gangs that are identifying themselves as that and grouping together and either going out and assaulting or threatening. Okay. Certainly I'm sure there is some of that, but it's not I don't think it's widespread yet or very visible in daily operations.
What about drugs and contraband in the various correctional facilities in the state?
I don't think that there would be any increase due to any recent events, whether it's gangs or less or more prisoners in the facility. I suspect that as long as you have a person locked up, that you'll always have some level of contraband. We look at that, you know, constantly, whether it's searching the people when they come in or searching the mail when that comes in, or And a sensitive area is we talked about before is visitors coming in, person coming in off the street. They're not a criminal, they don't want to be treated like one, but there is a percentage of that population coming in whose sole purpose is to bring in contraband. So there's a balance of, you know, how intrusive do we want to be on the public that's coming into the facilities.
And what about protecting what wouldn't generally be considered confidential information, protecting addresses for correction officers and folks in management? Is that an issue as we begin to address that with public safety? Is that something that you would recommend as an additional safety precaution that we might want to contemplate offering to your workforce as well?
Chairman Remmers, that's been an issue for as long as I can remember about, you know, when we used to see that years ago, primarily would be if, you know, if a prisoner was charged with a crime in the facility and staff were going to be called as witness or whatever, or a suit. As the court paperwork was going back and forth, you would see on occasion that not only was the officer's name listed, but instead of his work address, his home address would be there. And certainly staff have always and probably always will have concern about their personal information becoming public, particularly to the prison population. The reference you made before about the meth house in finding the names and addresses of police officers. I haven't heard that about ours, but certainly, you know, our officers are going to be involved in enforcing security in the institutions and allowing or not allowing activities that criminal element tries to continue in the correctional facilities, and certainly we have concern about our personal information being made public.
Okay. Other questions for the gentleman? Representative Lynn? It's 10 minutes after 3. We want to thank you for an excellent presentation today. And our compliments, the committee's compliments, for many of the vast improvements in feathering out that bell curve and the way that we're caring for the prison population, the correctional officers, and seeing to enhance safety for the public. As we reduce recidivism, fewer crimes are committed, and we're delighted with the strides that you're making, and look forward to more follow-up just an exceptional presentation today. We thank you very much. Any final questions for these two gentlemen? Any remarks, Representative Dahlstrom?
Just a comment. I had a meeting with Commissioner Schmidt yesterday, and he expressed to me that he was sorry he wasn't able to be here. He was previously committed to the Finance Committee, but he did express his confidence in you two and how he wasn't worried at all about anything going on in this meeting because of your high standards. So I just wanted to put that on record and to pass that on to you and to tell you thank you very much. We know you have 24-hour-a-day jobs. They don't just stop when you go off shift. Thank you.
Representative Lynn?
Well, I want to join in thanking you for the work you do. I guess it's your motto or something that you have the toughest beat in Alaska, and I think that's certainly true. I actually worked in a non-penitentiary. I worked in a jail. I spent two Christmases in jail, bad as a jailer, not anything else, in the city of Tucson. And even in a little tiny, ugly city jail we had in Tucson back in the 50s, it was a mess, and nothing compared to what I've seen here when I visited prison. And it's a very sporty job, very tough job, even in that very limited experience that I had. I want to thank you guys for the job that you're keeping the good guys out and the bad guys in.
Thank you very much.
All right, very good. And Jane, we are still working away on our report. It's in
final proof right now.
Final proof.
Okay.
And for those of you that are going to be in the building until 5-ish, we are going to endeavor to try and get it to you today. If I can remind the committee, particularly, I think Representative Holmes and Representative Gruenberg, who not with us because we do take on specific legislation that's in the building right now that happens to be minority legislation here in this building and Democrat legislation over on the Senate side. And so I would encourage you to get a copy before you leave today so that an alternate point of view can be presented, and I'll remind you that what we would welcome is an addendum by any other members at this table. And then we have two bills before us on Monday. One of them is a minor fix-it bill for minor consuming that we did last year. I'm not sure what the other.
That's the one we start with every year.
False caller ID.
Yes, sir. And it should give us ample time, depending on the airplane flights and Mount Redoubt. the ability to go over the report in its final form and vote it out of committee so that we can release it to our colleagues on both sides of the building and the administration and the media and the general public. And so our objective is to try to have a draft to you here shortly. We'd hope to have it by 3 o'clock.
And you would want to have any addendum we might do back to you no later than when?
We would like to see the addendum back Monday when we...
Sometime at the meeting?
When we convene. And if it's not convenient, if you find that you need another couple of days, we'd be happy to to hold the report. But our desire is really to get it out to the public, and we certainly wrote a lay person's report, so it's we didn't sit down in a smoke-filled room with experts in the industry. We think it's a very balanced approach to a very complex issue, but it would be benefited from having alternative points of view represented in it as well. And I would encourage you to do that, and Representative Gruenberg also in particular.
I will send out a PDF copy too, whether it's final proofed or not. I will make sure you guys have a PDF.
Okay, so we'll send out an electronic version today, and then a hard copy.
You possibly email to my home email.
Okay, all right. We'll take care of that off the record. It's 3:15, gentlemen. Thank you again. Exceptional presentation. Our compliments to Commissioner Schmidt, and we'll look forward to talking to some of our friends in the Corrections Union and make sure that we're all on the same page, but it's got to be impressive, and there have to be improvements there given the pressure that you've taken off the system. So our hats are off to you. Thank you very much. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.